According to the Centers for Disease Control, an estimated 76 million people in the United States suffer foodborne illnesses each year, resulting in about 300,000 hospitalizations and 5,000 deaths. The Obama administration has called for improved food safety policies, and there's new food safety legislation that has passed the House but is currently languishing in the Senate. On today's edition of Please Explain, we're taking a look at the causes of foodborne illness, how we can prevent them, and what the new legislation calls for. And joining us are Dr. Craig Hedberg, professor in the Division of Environmental Health Services at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, and Dr. Phyllis Della Lotta, professor of clinical pathology in medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Craig, if someone reports a case of foodborne illness to the Department of Health, what happens next?
When somebody reports a foodborne illness to the Department of Health, it depends in part on what the nature of the complaint is. There's generally two ways that we learn about outbreaks. One is when people eat at a restaurant and get sick and they think that the restaurant was the source of their illness. That information will come into the health department, and if there are multiple illnesses that seem to be linked to that complaint, that will launch a direct investigation to identify what the source of that contamination might have been. The other is when people get sick and they go in to see a physician, have a stool sample collected, and then that results in the identification of a specific disease like Salmonella or E. coli 0157. That information will be forwarded to the health department, and then that will lead to an investigation to try to identify what the source of that illness may be.
Well, you used to work for the Minnesota Department of Health. How did you investigate an outbreak?
Basically, what we start out doing is talking to the people who got sick. We want to identify what food items they ate, and then we have to have a comparison group. So we try to talk to people who were not ill and see what the differences in those food consumption patterns were. Now, in the case of an event like a wedding party or a graduation party, where we unfortunately see events coming up in the next month or so, if there is a menu that we can use that all the people exposed ate off the common menu, then we have a very simple framework for an analysis. We can, you know, talk to all the people who got sick who were at the event, talk to the people who weren't sick who were at the event, and see what food items were more commonly eaten by the people who got sick. Then following that, there may be attempts to try to collect food and test that to confirm the whether the bacteria or virus might have been present in that food item as well. And environmental health evaluation of the facility where the food was produced to identify what food handling mistakes might have been made to lead to the occurrence of that disease.
If you discover that it's something broader and a recall might be necessary, who determines that? The FDA, the state, the manufacturer, or the distributor of the produce?
Usually there is a very energetic discussion among all of those parties. The system we have in the United States right now, recalls of food products are voluntary recalls on the part of the manufacturer or the distributor, but those are almost always done in conjunction with the investigation by public health officials and with the concurrence of the regulatory authority, in many cases, a state Department of Agriculture or the FDA. And everybody very quickly reviews the available information, and a plan of action is put into place that that everybody supports.
Phyllis, have you been following this food safety bill that's before Congress, the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act?
Well, actually, I'm very confident that something will be done. Part of that confidence just comes from the fact that the Food and Drug Commissioner, Dr. Margaret Hamburg, is a former New Yorker that was our Commissioner of Health here and did some great work with TB and lots of other public health issues that we had here in the city at that time. So this seems to be a priority with her, and I really do feel that there will be more watchdogs, citizen watchdogs. There will be more regulations and more sort of proactive rather than reactive legislation that goes on regarding food poisoning.
Well, as I said, it's already passed the House, but it's been held up in the Senate. What are the objections? What's holding it up?
Money, I would assume. It costs money to do some of these things.
Uh-huh.
In order to get the food manufacturing plants and food preparation plants to put some measures in action, it's going to take quite a bit of funding, extra money. Also, in order for us to have more inspectors, that's going to cost the federal government more money. So it all comes down to where do we want to put our dollars.
And where would those inspections be? Would we be going down to the farm level?
Well, actually, you have to consider all levels. You know, if you think in terms of farms, of course, you have to think in terms of slaughterhouses as well. You have to think about the preparation and food handling, both at home, which is actually the easiest thing to think about. We can actually prevent quite a bit by education, and that might be the best route and one of the good routes that we would be following.
But it would suggest that the current situation is inadequate. Do we not have an adequate – has the FDA not enough power to inspect on the level that it should?
Yes. Yeah, there is not enough funding to have inspectors. There isn't enough funding to investigate things like, let's say, irradiation of beef and to adequately look into that, to see how safe it is, to see if it affects the taste of food, to look into things like pasteurizing shelled eggs, for example. To look into, again, more education and more inspectors to go around to restaurants to see that when we're ordering Caesar salad or hollandaise sauce, that they're using pasteurized eggs, and so that we're not subjected to the salmonella that one would consume with raw eggs.
My guests are Dr. Phyllis Dellalata, Professor of Clinical Pathology in Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Craig Hedberg, Professor in the Division of Environmental Health Services at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. We're talking about foodborne illnesses and food safety on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Craig, do guidelines vary much from state to state?
Well, we have, in the regulatory arena, the way on a national level foods are organized, the USDA is responsible for meat and poultry products. FDA has regulatory authority over most of the vast majority of foods that are in interstate commerce. And at the state level, then we have regulatory authorities in state departments of agriculture and state health departments. And there are multiple and overlapping jurisdictions that involve the production of most of our food. Interestingly, you talked about going down to the farm, and that is one area where nobody really has a lot of regulatory authority, and there's a lot of concern about how we manage farm environments, since that really is the start of the food chain, and a lot of our contamination problems that we're dealing with start out as contamination of raw ingredients that then move into the processing environments.
Well, since a lot of our food comes from overseas, how are international suppliers handled? Does the FDA play a role in ensuring that that produce that's been flown in from Chile, for example, or from China, or other kinds of foods, meats from overseas, are safe?
Well, USDA has specific requirements that meat coming into the U.S. basically gets slaughtered and processed in facilities that are under inspection that is sort of the equivalent of the USDA authorities. FDA has been doing a lot in the past few years to work with other countries to enhance inspection of foods in those remote areas. And one of the important parts of our food safety system is the public health system that identifies the source of outbreaks. And FDA has been very good at working with the public health agency so that when a foreign source of contamination in, say, an outbreak of salmonella that gets traced to cantaloupes coming in from Mexico, FDA has worked with Mexican authorities to try to address those issues. There was a period of time where there were some restrictions on imports placed until FDA could be assured that improved production practices were in place to make those melons safer. But frankly, a lot of the concerns we have about contamination and production are not unique to foreign production environments. The challenges of growing food safely are really ones that are international in scope.
Phyllis, what are the symptoms of foodborne illness? And when we say somebody's got food poisoning, are we saying the same thing?
Well, mainly the symptoms, obviously, are diarrhea, copious diarrhea, and vomiting. But there are different ways of distinguishing or trying to distinguish one type from another. Firstly, I mean, it's usually due either to a pathogen that you would ingest, and it's the pathogen itself, the inflammation and so on that's making you ill. And then it's also the consumption of toxins. And toxins in and of themselves usually act with a shorter time frame, within a shorter what we would call incubation period. And toxins, it's different. And we have to understand that antibiotics is not a cure for this. So when we do try to investigate to see what's causing it, so if a patient presents to the emergency room with diarrhea and vomiting diarrhea and vomiting, we have to look to see if there's blood in the stool, and that kind of gives us an indication. If the patient's febrile, then blood has to be collected. And then we analyze it, which means that we plate it onto different types of media and see what grows. Or we can do, in the case of certain viruses, such as you've heard of the norovirus, which is, again, we have to think in terms of water as well as food. And
those neuroviruses are the things that break out often on cruise ships.
Oh, the cruise ships were plagued with it. And so now there's Purell and washing with soap and water, which is actually the best thing because Purell doesn't work all that well with norovirus. But, so there are PCR assays that we can use in order to detect certain pathogens and distinguish one from the other, and that is important. It's important in terms of how this particular patient is treated.
Well, if I, to be honest, if I were to suffer from something like this, my first reaction would be go to bed and it'll be over in the morning. How do I know when it's more serious and I should be seeing a doctor or going to the emergency room?
Well, you know it's serious when you have your febrile and there's really a lot of loss of fluid. And you're going to know you're going to need some hydration. Because it's not just loss of fluid, it's loss of the electrolytes. So you're feeling weak, you're feeling chills. This lasts more than overnight. Then you go see a doctor or you go to the ED. If you happen to be pregnant, then this is an urgent situation that you must go. If you have symptoms of that sort, you must go and see a doctor immediately or go into the ED.
Because the poisons, the toxins, will then affect the fetus?
Well, particularly if it's listeria. So we have to find out what's causing the illness. And if you're immune compromised, that's another patient population or HIV positive that has to be a bit more careful because the immune system is not optimal.
Can foodborne illnesses lead to chronic health problems?
Some can, particularly parasitic ones. Bacterial No, but you can be a carrier. So you can end up, we all heard of Typhoid Mary, but aside from Salmonella typhi, you can end up being a carrier in your stool of Salmonella. And so the testing of food handlers for carrying Salmonella is important, but I think we can't lose sight of the fact that a lot can be prevented if we just use good practices that some of us just think of as common sense, but it isn't. Safe food handling and preparation and washing one's hands and food storage and cooking of food, heating food. There's not enough education on the TV, on radio shows, et cetera, on how we can prevent it. I mean, assuming the legislation is going to go through, assuming that that the parties that be either pass or don't pass legislation, what can we do as citizens to protect ourselves? And it's quite a lot.
Well, I'm sure we'll cover most of those in the second part of this segment, because we'll be taking calls from our listeners, and also they'll be writing in with comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Our phone number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Dr. Hedberg, I hear you want to add something, but can we take a little break and we'll come back to you?
Sure.
We're talking about foodborne illnesses and food safety with Dr. Craig Hedberg, professor in the Division of Environmental Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, and Dr. Phyllis Dellalata, professor of clinical pathology and medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. Again, the number 212-433-9692, or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Back with Please Explain, and our guests, Dr. Phyllis Dellalata and Dr. Craig Hedberg, and your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we got two comments that relate to each other. So let's start off with those. Aaron in Manhattan says, could your guests explain the dangers posed by concentrated animal feeding operation industrial farms where the majority of meat in the market is raised? And Tim from New Jersey asks, is there any evidence that producing certified organic beef where no antibiotics are used will reduce the levels of dangerous bacteria, the bad E. coli strains in the meat? And I don't care which one of you starts, because both of you obviously know an awful lot about this stuff.
And if I could jump in, Leonard, the issue of antibiotic use hasn't really been shown to be directly related to the frequency with which animals may carry bacteria or not. We've done some work looking at dairy operations in the upper Midwest, and we're equally as likely to find E. coli 157 or Salmonella in organic farms as well as some of the conventional farms. I think the issue regarding the concentrated animal feeding operations is one that has raised a lot of attention. And certainly when we have a lot of animals crammed into a relatively small space, it does create some conditions that can foster transmission of these animals, transmission of some of these organisms in these animals. But I think it's not really clear that that's the primary cause of a lot of our disease outbreaks.
Yeah, I would just like to add, you're absolutely right, Craig. I agree totally. But there is a huge problem with adding antibiotics to animal feed, and that problem is one that is translating right now to the immense crisis that we have with multidrug-resistant pathogens in general. We all know about MRSA, but that's not really the main reason. It's the gram-negative organisms that are becoming almost pan-resistant, and a lot of that is being fostered by selective action due to these antibiotics, that some of which we are ingesting and becoming part of our normal flora as humans.
Let's take some calls. We go now to Jan from Brooklyn. Hi, Jan, you're on the air.
Hi, just yesterday I saw some molds in a food, like in a health food store, a tiny little white thing, and I could feel the bad energy. Plus, when I go, like, to, I see these berries that come from, like, golden berries come from other countries, and there's, like, a white tip with a mold. I even mentioned it to somebody, and it feels horrible.
Are they dangerous, doctors?
Aflatoxins can be produced. You can have toxins produced by molds, yes. But I think there are certain berries, particularly raspberries, that tend to get fungus and contaminated. And, of course, you should not purchase them.
What about the molds on cheeses? And then as a follow-up, a listener left a question on our show page saying, I have a large container of ricotta cheese with a Best Buy date of May 23rd. It got lost in the back of the fridge, and I rediscovered it yesterday. It was still sealed, and it smells fresh, but it tastes fine. Should I not eat it? If it's okay to eat, how quickly will it go bad? And if I use it to bake something, will the even heat kill any or all potential bugs?
The issue of best buy dates or sell by dates and food safety aren't always straightforward relationships. And frankly, if that package were in my refrigerator and it looked and smelled good, I might be inclined to eat it myself. But having said that,
is smell really a key way of determining whether something is safe or dangerous?
Well, I think if there are off odors or off colors or off tastes that you don't associate with the product, it's an indication that there's something wrong there. And I think whenever there's any concern about the safety of a food product, you should dispose of it and not eat it. But most of the things that are going to cause food to spoil aren't actually the harmful bacteria that are going to cause you to be sick. And actually, the one concern that we have with foods that are stored in refrigerators that can be held for a long time is Listeria, because this is a bacteria that can actually grow at refrigerator temperatures. We use refrigeration as a safety tool because a lot of our pathogenic bacteria don't grow when food is properly refrigerated. And so we make recommendations that you keep foods cold to prevent the growth of bacteria. Listeria is the one organism that is harmful that actually can grow under those conditions.
And what kinds of foods would we find Listeria in?
Well, that has been associated with soft cheeses, and also we've had a number of outbreaks in the United States with sliced deli meats.
Now, if we heated them up, if we had that cheese and we made a grilled cheese sandwich, would that have killed the Listeria?
I think if you are making a grilled cheese sandwich where you're melting the cheese, you're probably not going to be getting temperatures that are adequate to kill the bacteria. Certainly, all of these bacteria can be killed by proper heating. And so when we cook chicken or ground beef, we want to make sure that we are achieving temperatures in the meat that will be capable of killing the bacteria.
And what about botulism, Phyllis? That's sounds like the most dangerous of all of these foodborne illnesses, is it?
Yeah, well, botulinum is one of the most deadly toxins that it's available. I mean, it's amazing that people are injecting Botox for another reason. But we don't have to worry about it anymore. We used to when people used to do home canning, but it's really not as prevalent with canned goods. You can still see its presence in honey, for example, in maybe salted fish, but canned goods had been the primary reason. So it's not really among the top 10 in terms of, in the United States, of food poisoning. Listeria, I might add, is really a big, big problem, and the soft cheeses and the rest have to be, and deli meats and hot dogs and so on have to be avoided by pregnant women.
So if I have some brie in the refrigerator, how would I know whether it might be carrying listeria?
You don't.
Ah, well, great. Okay, so that means that you're telling me not to buy brie?
Unless, well, is it pasteurized? Isn't it pasteurized?
Uh-huh.
I like to stick to pasteurized cheese.
Okay, we go now to Michael from Brooklyn. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Michael.
Oh, hi. Yeah, my question is not exactly directly food-related, but it relates to the discussion on salmonella. I own a pet snake, and I've been told that they can often carry salmonella and that we should wash our hands with soap and water after handling it. And I was wondering if your guests thought that was adequate or if there was some other stronger precautions to take or something else to use so as not to spread salmonella to then, you know, touching your hands or face or whatever.
Thank you.
Actually, turtles and snakes and iguanas have a very high carriage rate for salmonella.
Now, why is salmonella even show up in things like pistachio nuts and peanut butter? Is it also, is it snakes and nuts?
No, those are different reasons. I mean, I know it's been in peanut butter, and we've seen outbreaks in cookie dough and peanut butter, and that's a food processing plant problem, because don't forget salmonella gets spread in the feces. I would be concerned with this listener if you had children at home. I would have the feces tested on your particular reptile.
Now, the major outbreaks often involve E. coli, and it's everything from hamburger to lettuce and spinach. Is that all because they're being handled by humans?
Well, E. coli, particularly E. coli 0157, is an organism that appears most strongly associated with cattle. And the ground beef outbreaks, of course, happen because when we convert cattle into meat, the slaughter process is not a sanitary process per se, and so there's contamination of the tissues that then get into the meat that you buy at the grocery store. With a lot of the leafy green vegetable outbreaks, those seem to be due to contamination of the lettuce or spinach that is probably occurring as a result of having cattle in the environment nearby.
And if we cook the hamburger to a certain temperature, are we killing
the bacteria? That will kill the E. coli, yes.
But we're not going to be cooking the lettuce, obviously.
That's right.
Now, what about handling food in our own homes? I've often been told that I should wash my hand every time I touch chicken. But I've also heard that cutting boards can be a big issue, and I'm not sure whether separate cutting boards for meat and other foods is necessary, whether wooden cutting boards are any better than the plastic ones.
I personally recommend plastic when I give my lectures. Wooden, once they get scarred, it's a beautiful place for bacteria to hide and multiply in the little crevices that are there. You have to be very, very careful to really separate raw from cooked. And I would have separate boards, I do. And I Clorox my sink, I wash my hands. You can put your cutting board, again, I say plastic is the best, in the dishwasher. It has hot soapy water, and soap and water is just great in terms of eliminating things.
And we don't wash those wooden cutting boards. We wipe them off.
Well, that's why I dislike them. Yeah. They're very nice for show.
Yeah, they're much prettier.
Oh, they're pretty. Just don't.
I'm always afraid that the bacteria getting into all of those little cuts that I'm putting into the plastic.
They are. Oh, the plastic, you shouldn't, yeah. I mean, once they start looking bad, but plastic, don't forget, you can clean. You can clean very well. You put them in dishwashers. You can clean them with any detergent. Soak
Let's
them so they can be clean.
Peter from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
I wondered. I am a chef, and I do private cooking lessons and instructional cooking parties. And I always, you know, I always do my little joke about how chicken is foul, and people are always like, ha, ha, ha. But that being said, chicken is just nasty, and I always say if kosher laws were being rewritten today, chicken would be against the rules and pork would be allowed. but it's amazing how many grandmothers and mothers have convinced everyone that when you get a chicken home, you should wash it in your sink. And it seems to me that you're just, and I always tell my clients this, you're splashing salmonella all over the place, and you know, increasing the likelihood that the salad that's sitting next to the sink is going to get infected. I mean, we all know that we're not to eat undercooked chicken, and that's just ingrained in our heads. And I would be, you know, willing to go out on a limb and say that most of the salmonella that people get in this country is from cross-contamination and not from eating undercooked chicken, and certainly not eggs. I mean, I eat raw eggs all the time and have never been sick. But
so let's ask our guests. Do you agree?
Well, I would certainly agree that that cross-contamination is an issue, and chicken is a concern also for Campylobacter, which is another important bacterial cause of foodborne illness. But the observation that that he's eaten eggs and raw eggs and never gotten sick leads me to a point I'd like to come back to in a minute.
Well, we have very little time, but you're suggesting that he's lucky, I suspect.
Right.
Audra in Manhattan wants to know about the safest sushi. About 2 years ago, she said she was hospitalized for severe food poisoning that was traced back to raw fish. She had eaten 24 hours earlier. She'd like to eat sushi again, but she's afraid. Is sushi generally okay?
It depends. There really is no safe way of sanitizing, of you know, an equivalent to pasteurizing raw fish. I mean, what you are supposed to do in good practice is to freeze fish before. I mean, so it's raw fish and you freeze it. And if you freeze that, then you can kill the parasites. Now, are you actually sure that the restaurant that you go to is doing that? No.
It also usually is the better restaurants have really fresher fish. I would go to a restaurant where a lot of people eat the sushi rather than one or two customers, and it's been sitting around for a while. But we've run out of time. I want to thank the two of you so much for talking with us today on Please Explain, our look at foodborne illnesses and food safety. Dr. Phyllis Dellalata of the Columbia University Medical Center and Dr. Craig Hedberg of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.